ladies and gentlemen. I trust that you can hear me reasonably well. I would like to welcome everybody to this issue-specific hearing, which is the third issue-specific hearing held in this examination. My name is Rin Smith, and I am the lead member of a panel appointed on the 2nd of October 2018 under Sections 61 and 65 of the Planning Act of 2008 as amended under delegation from the Secretary of State to examine the Thanet offshore wind farm extension. Now, I have made a declaration of interests responding to the Planning Inspectorate's conflict of interests policy and can confirm that I have no declarable interests in relation to this appointment. If anybody wishes to hear the detail around declarations of interest by the panel, I would point you to the digital audio on the examination website of the preliminary meeting, where at the start you will hear declarations of interest. My fellow panel members were appointed on the same date, and I will now ask them briefly to introduce themselves. So, to my right.
Hi, I'm Jessica Powis, and I can confirm that I have no declarable interests in relation to my appointment.
And then to my left.
I'm Stephen Bradley. I previously made a declaration of interest that I was a volunteer for the Thames Estuary Partnership, writing as a freelance journalist, and I have since ceased involvement with that since being appointed to this panel.
Okay, thank you very much. And then from the Planning Inspectorate, I will also introduce, firstly, at the rear of the room, Mr. Dean Alford, who is our case officer, and Ms. Manveer Full, who is another case officer. Between the two of them, if you ever have any questions whatsoever about anything that's actually going to occur today, please do make yourself known to them, and if needs be, they can refer matters to us. Now, as I've indicated, we're examining an application for development consent for the Thanet Offshore Wind Farm Extension, which is a nationally significant infrastructure project, and the application has been made by Vattenfall Limited, who we are going to refer to from now on as the applicant. Now, I trust that everybody here is reasonably familiar with the application, and I don't need to recite or remind you of any of its details. No, that's good. I'm then going to introduce you briefly to the venue. Can I just have a show of hands? Are there people who have not been to this venue before? Ah, right, so we are going to have to do a little bit more than just the basic introduction. There are, ladies and gentlemen, toilet facilities. Immediately to my left, to the rear, are ladies' facilities. Through the double doors at the back of the room, to my right, are gents' facilities. There are no fire drills anticipated today, other than the one we have already had. So if you hear another evacuation tone, as of now, then it is going to be the real thing. And if that happens, we've been asked to proceed down the stairs into the lobby, and there are then, directly beneath us, underneath the glazed wall, fire doors that lead out into the courtyard area, and that's where we've been asked to assemble. I've also been asked to draw your attention to the fact that apparently there is a television crew in the building, a film crew, and I would hasten to add that that is apparently for the filming of a completely separate television programme, nothing to do with this examination, and therefore, although you may see cameras and people walking around, associated with cameras, nothing to worry about, nothing to do with us. We will let them get on with their business, and they, we trust, will let us get on with ours. Now, in terms of making progress into the agenda for today and the subject matters of this hearing, I'm now going to hand over to Jessica Powis, who is actually going to lead the majority of today's hearing. So, Ms. Powis.
Thank you. So can I direct you to Annex A of our examining authority's letter dated the 7th of February, which contains our agenda. Does anybody not have an agenda in need when we have got some spare hard copies? Okay. Lovely. So this morning's hearing concerns environmental matters, ecology, habitats regulations assessment, and physical construction and other matters. And those purposes are set out in that agenda. I won't go through them.
Can I just briefly say that we do have a number of screens in the room, and we have the applicant able to project documents relevant to the agenda. Mm-hmm. What would help, I think, is to actually have the agenda itself available. And so if those can go onto the screen, and then when we need to look at particular documents, we'll put particular documents onto the screens. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thank you. Given that you know who's involved from the planning inspectorate, then could we go around the table and do some introductions so we know who we have here today? If you're just here to observe or support another person, we don't need you to introduce yourself, but if you do intend to speak, then we would like to hear who you are and broadly your interest in the project. For example, I represent a local authority. I should just add at the moment that all of our meetings and hearings are digitally recorded and published on our website, hence the microphones, and please don't speak unless your red light is on is the main message from our audio colleagues, so that we do capture everything that is said today. I'll also just run through quickly about some of our general data protection regulation obligations, because the recording taken today forms a public record that could contain personal information. Our practice is to retain and publish recordings for a period of 5 years from the Secretary of State's decision on the development consent order. So if you participate in the hearing process, it's important you understand you will be recorded and that you consent to retention and publication of that digital recording. We will only ask for information to be placed on the public record that's important and relevant to a planning decision. It will only be in the rarest of circumstances that we ask you to provide personal information of the type that we might that you might prefer to keep private or confidential. So the main message is avoid giving any personal information. If you really need to give anything that would be that would represent personal information, then if you could inform us that that's about to happen, and then we can make a marker for our digital recording and manage it that way.
Essentially here, ladies and gentlemen, what we are very strongly conscious of is that we don't want, because it actually affects the integrity of the digital record, to ever be in a situation where we have to edit the digital record. And so what we normally advise folk is that if you do have to say anything personal at all for any reason, that actually there are other ways of bringing it into the examination, that it could, for example, come in as a written document, which can then be redacted. So there are ways around these things.
Okay, so I think we'll start on my right then and run around the table, coming to the applicant last, please.
Hi, Lisa Southwood from the Marine Management Organisation. We would be responsible for management of any discharge of licensing requirements, post-consent, and managing compliance and enforcement under Marine Coastal Access Act.
Thank you.
Julia Hunt from Kent Wildlife Trust. We are a land manager, land owner, and we're a nature conservation organisation with an interest in planning.
Thank you.
Vincent Ganley, also from Kent Wildlife Trust, lead on planning for the Trust.
Thank you.
Alice Morley, also from Kent Wildlife Trust. I'm a marine conservation officer.
Thank you.
Andrew Shaw, planning advisor for the National Trust, London South East, representing as a landowner.
Thank you.
Lucinda Roach, Principal Planner at Dover District Council, representing the local authority.
Thank you.
Sammy Mullen from Gobi Consultants on behalf of the applicant, and I'll be providing information on the screens during this hearing.
Thank you.
Ian Baker, Electrical Engineer, representing the applicant.
Dalia Benchabane, Project Design Lead, representing the applicant.
Sandra Hayes, Senior Project Manager with Vattenfall Wind Power, representing the applicant.
Thank you.
Dan Bates, Consents Manager for the applicant.
Sean Leake, Gobi Consultants, the EIA lead for the project and for the applicant.
Scott Linus, Barrister, representing the applicant. And we have a large team here today, so we have a second row of consultants who may be speaking. And I can tell you their names to save them coming up to the microphone. We have Mike Furness at the far end, who'll be giving evidence for Vattenfall potentially. We have Duncan Watson. We have Sean Sweeney. Then we have Dr. Roger Buesen. Then we have Sally Kayser. And finally, we have Ryan.
Surname? McManus.
Ryan McManus.
Thank you. Okay, so I think introductions are now complete. So before we move on to the second item on our agenda, does anybody have any other questions of an introductory nature before we get into the detail? Okay, then I'll pass over to my colleague, Mr. Smith, for the second agenda item.
Thank you very much. Essentially, this is almost by way of a kind of mini preliminary meeting within a hearing, but we did feel that at this stage, having gone past deadlines one and two, that it was important, recognising that Section 51 advice was issued early in the piece on behalf of the examining authority, requesting that the applicant make various submissions that brought new documents in, amending the documents in the original application document set, and that has been done. We need, before passing that point and considering formally whether or not to accept those documents, to just provide an opportunity for anybody who might wish to raise any concern about their content or any broader concern that there might be others, maybe even not in this room, who somehow ought to be made aware of those documents or specifically consulted on any part of them to speak briefly. So can I just check where we are with those documents and whether anybody has any concern about them, any concern that we should not for any particular reason accept them, or any concern that other persons need to be involved and alerted to them? None whatsoever. Well, that's simple and straightforward. Now, just before we move on, in relation to the applicant's... I will leave that to the next item. I'll just check with my colleagues. Are we content?
Yeah.
Content. In which case, there's nothing for the applicant to reply to unless you wish
Sir, I just wanted to clarify, obviously at deadline one, we announced the decision to remove landfall option two in appendix 45 to the deadline one submission. And at deadline two, we confirmed that position and we have provided documents which required some amendments to take on board that proposed withdrawal. Can I just confirm, given where we are in the agenda, that there is no outstanding issue about the withdrawal of that option procedurally, and that we can proceed on the basis that the examining authority is content that that option is now withdrawn and the relevant documents have been provided?
Very largely you can.
Yes.
And I say very largely, I caveat that slightly, because what I'm conscious of is the fact that as we march through today's and indeed some of the subsequent agendas this week, there will be opportunities for interested parties to make substantive comment on those changes. And I'm not in any sense going to rule them out, so that they will have an opportunity to raise any issues that might emerge, which can include the relationship between the withdrawal and the other options that are still on the table.
Understood.
But other than that, no, I think you're on reasonably safe territory.
Linus, for the applicant, thank you very much for that.
And look, I'm conscious that I'm being studiedly vague. What we will do is that we will make a formal procedural decision. I think the best indication that I can give about that is that we will reserve that to be put in writing at the end of this particular sequence of hearings, when we publish our final action lists.
And Scott Liners for the applicant. Thank you for that, sir.
Hopefully then that manages that issue. In which case, ladies and gentlemen, unless there's anything else to be raised, we can then move into the substance of today's hearing. And what we are first going to look at are two items, 3 and 4, on construction effects. We're going to start at C, and then we're going to move to construction and operational effects on land. These are necessarily going to be just very brief dips into these matters, because I flag that the primary business of today really starts at agenda item 5. Nevertheless, firstly looking at construction effects at C, what we want to have a brief look at is the documentation provided by the application by the applicant in relation to foundations and trenching. The reason that we just did wish to raise this orally is that in the applicant's Annex B responses to relevant representations, as we worked through that material, we did find what we felt were some difficulties with some of the maths. Not to put too fine a point on it, there were some figures that were at variance from that we had expected. Does this surprise you, Mr. Linus?
Or Scott Linus for the applicant. No, sir, in relation to some aspects, particularly relating to disposal volumes, we'd spotted a need to review aspects of the DCO to ensure consistency with the Appendix 1 Annex A document that was submitted at deadline 1 setting out the parameters for the project.
Yeah.
So we're aware that we need to look at the DCO and cross-check that, but obviously any other points specifically you want to raise with us this morning, we can pick those up and review those in due course.
Okay. It was particularly Rep 1023, and let's just have a quick look at that on screen. Can we pop that on screen?
It was Annex B.
Annex B.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, now, if we just scroll through this. I think we might have just been there. Just scroll back down again.
Is that big?
Essentially, yes. I mean, we're looking here at a series of maximum volume figures. And we just had a slight concern that some of them, I guess, would benefit from attention and just final confirmation that they are either correct or if they need to be amended further, that happen. The reason why we just wanted to check these was essentially because at this juncture, we need to be absolutely clear about the volumes of material, for example, that emerges from jetting of export cable trenches, because at the end of the day, the amount of that material and its dispersion or disposal is material to the view that we take on the environmental impact that emerges. So, yeah, we did just want to put you onto a final check of those figures, please. And what I would highlight, actually, is that if that was something that, would it be too difficult to maybe look at those figures over the lunchtime?
I was going to suggest, Sir Scott Linus for the applicant, I'm sure that can be done relatively quickly. We'll certainly look at that over the lunch adjournment and come back to you if we were able to do that.
Yeah, because if you could, then immediately after lunch break, we'll just slip back into sort of semi-process mode, and if those figures do need to be corrected in any way, then we can alert people who might be interested in that. Okay. Is there anybody else who wants, in principle now, interested parties here to speak in relation to construction effects at sea? Are there matters that anybody here wishes to put? Don't think you're
Hello?
Connecting.
Is that on? Yeah. Alice Morley from Kent Wildlife Trust. We mentioned in our written representation our desire to have the cables buried to at least a metre, preferably 1.5 metres depth. And we understand that the applicant has responded to that, but we would just like to say if it is at all possible that should be the aim and not just go towards the mitigation effects for that point.
I mean, can I just explore that a little further? Are you seeking any additional security for that isn't already there?
Just reassurance that that will be the aim.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right. Is there anybody else wanting to put anything to us on construction effects at sea? No. In which case, let us then move relatively swiftly to construction and operational effects on land. Now, essentially here, what we wanted to do before we go any further through this examination process is to provide an opportunity for anyone who has concerns about construction and operational effects on land. And I do add here that in this basket, we see operations that are of interest to Kent Wildlife Trust, Kent County Council, and National Trust as being in here, because we're taking salt marsh impacts, the landfall, as part of this. If there are remaining concerns that people wish to draw to our attention, we would like to have those brought out. So can I just check on this side of the table and see if there are folk who wish to speak to any of these items? We have a number of bids to speak. So can I just check here that is Kent Wildlife Trust and the National Trust? Okay. MMO? Nothing to add. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do then is, if we look at the broad bundle of matters that we had raised, A through to H, you will not be interested in all of them. But given that you're here, I think the fairest and most sensible thing to do is to ask you to speak to your particular items first. We'll get those onto the table, and then the panel can embroider into the tapestry with possibly some residual questions about the other items that don't have people represented at today's hearing. So, can I go to Kent Wildlife Trust first and then the National Trust?
Alice Morley, Kent Wildlife Trust. Our main issues that we would like to speak to today is about 4A, so the landfall and cable route options and construction methods. That's our main point for that agenda item.
Okay, the floor is yours.
Yeah, so as we have made clear in our written representations and responses, our issue is regarding the onshore cable route, as the route that's been chosen by the applicant crosses numerous environmental designations, including National Nature Reserve, an SAC, SSSI, SPA, and Ramsar site. So it's a really highly designated area for conservation. And we don't believe that the avoidance hierarchy has fully been followed. And we believe that there hasn't been full consideration of possible alternative routes that may well have resulted in less impact on these designations,
okay,
or had fewer interactions with those sites.
Right. Now, at this juncture, what I think it would help the panel very much for you to be aware of. We're clear from the reading of written representations that there are concerns about site selection and alternatives out with the application that's currently in front of us. Now, obviously, what we are not in a position to do is to examine something that is not on the table in front of us. We can't broadly task the applicant to go away and produce a landfall in a different place that's not actually part of this application. So essentially our question to you, arising from your written representations, is this. To the degree that your concerns have been raised, are you saying that relevant MPS policy tests are not met? Question one. And essentially then going beyond that, what ought be the consequences? So in other words, if you're saying that relevant policy tests are not met, is it your view that there are additional mitigating actions that either the applicant has in mind but are insufficiently specified or secured, or additional things they could do that they haven't offered yet? Or at the end of that, are you saying that you've thought all of this through and that actually there isn't anything additional that they could do, and that actually the response to where you find yourself is that you are suggesting to us that this application ought not be granted for reasons? That's, as we see it, the kind of the complex that folds out of your written material. So does that make sense to you?
Alice Morley, Kent Wildlife Trust. Yes, it does. It's an in-principle objection to crossing the designated sites. We do have some concerns about some of the surveys that were carried out. So in terms of what could be done from this point would relate to the survey effort on the chosen site. But again, the point remains that we don't believe that adequate surveys have been done across potential alternative routes. I do realise that that's potentially we're at the stage now where they can't go back and do those, but we feel it's a really important point to raise from our point of view in terms of the ecological information that's been provided.
Okay. So that to me sounds as though you are saying that you believe that there's probably not a lot of additional, not a lot of management of the existing mitigation that the applicant has proposed that they could do, not a lot of additional mitigation over and above what they've currently offered that would be relevant. Is that correct?
Vincent Gunley, Kent Wildlife Trust.
I don't think so. You're running to the digital recording. Can I just check with the sound tech? Just try again.
Vincent Gunley, Kent Wildlife Trust. Thank you. Yes, in essence, in more detail, comparable surveys, we don't believe there's comparable surveys done for the two options that were put forward, including the current option which goes through the site. We believe that there was poor provision of ecological information for consultation up until the application went in. We don't fully agree with output of certain surveys, specifically the botanical survey and the invert survey. And therefore, we question the standard of both of those surveys put forward. The risks in this sense are that there are, for example, nationally rare species such as lizard orchid, which was not made mention on the site, which would be part of this route option put forward today, which wouldn't be a temporary impact. It would be a long-term impact as the population of this species could be destroyed on a certain section of the site.
Okay. Now, I'm just at this point going to ask you, and if you don't immediately know the answers to these things, then we'll have to, I guess, find a way of working out how to get to this information. But we're conscious that that piece of salt marsh in the Pegwell Bay foreshore has been intervened previously. It's had the Nemo cables run across it. It's had the original Thanet offshore wind farm cables run across it. Potentially it's had others. What observations do you have about those previous crossings and their methods? Were you broadly content with what emerged from those crossings, or are you saying that they did damage that you would now seek to resist further damage of that nature? Are we looking at some... I guess what I'm trying to get to here is there something additional technical that the applicant can do that would satisfy you or that might be evidenced by some of the previous work that's occurred? Or alternatively, was the previous work bad and you're essentially saying you need to avoid the same error again?
Vincent Gunley, Kent Wildlife Trust. Yes, there were elements of the previous work which has been carried out subsequently, which wasn't in line with what we'd hoped as concerns the Nemo cable. We do believe the cumulative impacts will increase with each new development, and that hasn't been considered within the mitigation effects of the application. We believe this would lead to unforeseen or adverse impacts, as has happened with the Nemo cable. And there are certain impacts that we can pass on, which need to be considered, which have been damaging impacts on the site from
from the Nemo link cable. There's numerous ongoing issues with the existing cables, and we have concerns, obviously, that regarding any cable maintenance or further incursions on the site, that the resilience of the site itself is not a temporary impact, and that that beyond looking at the site as temporary impacts which can be mitigated against, there are certain impacts which we see are beyond temporary impacts and could be unforeseen impacts as potential long-term impacts for the site itself.
Okay. Right, can I just check with my colleagues whether there's anything else you want to pursue on?
Follow up on that point for the Kent Wildlife Trust. I note in some of your recent submissions reference to the Thanet cable replacement project and some concerns about this point of cumulative impacts of that project if it were to come forward. I think if it's okay at this point, I might just ask the applicant for an update on the status of that. So just from what I can see from the deadline two submissions, your response to that is that project was withdrawn and is not being progressed. I just wanted to check that is the current status. And also perhaps you could start by just explaining what that project was and why it was required.
Daniel Rates for the applicant. The project was, to be clear, this is not a project that I was involved in.
Yeah,
it was running for a long time before I joined Vattenfall. But as the name suggests, it was a consideration of replacing the export cables for the existing Thanet wind farm due to issues that windsanding is occurred further offshore. That marine license application has been withdrawn. There is no intention internally to revisit that. And so as a project, as a cumulative consideration, it's not on the table for consideration.
And so that was a project to replace the export cables in their entirety?
Yes.
And so has the need for that gone away then?
The issues with the cables have been determined that they will be dealt with through repair rather than replacement is fundamentally okay. Where the decision lay.
And is that work that's been undertaken or still planned?
I believe that's ongoing, but I'm not very familiar with that.
Okay. Can I just follow up briefly on that? I mean, you know, we may be in the land of soft information here, and that you know this has not been thought of even. But do you have a sense that the existing offshore cable will now be able to continue for its design life to essentially the decommissioning of the existing offshore wind farm? Or alternatively, do you have a sense that there will need to be an intervention before that time?
The withdrawal of the marine license was not a delay. It was a withdrawal in so much as that operation is not considered required, and that it will be managed through other measures, say specifically cable repair rather than replacement.
And so on that basis, then our understanding is that it's not factored into any of the cumulative or in combination assessments because it is not a project. It's not a project in any sense.
That is correct. Yeah.
So perhaps then we go back to the Kent Wildlife Trust. Is there anything that you would like to say to elaborate on what you've put into your written submissions or anything you've heard today on this particular point?
Alice Morley, Kent Wildlife Trust. That is reassuring that there's no plans to try and repair. Replace the existing cables. You can understand why that would be a concern given the cumulative impacts of numerous developments on the site. We just want to raise another point regarding cumulative impacts. We know that the round four of offshore wind farms are mm-hmm. coming through, and that's just been announced by the Crown Estate. And we feel that if cables are allowed to go across areas of multiple designated sites, this could set a precedent for future, and that is, of course, a concern for us.
And so that's not that precedent concern is not necessarily site specific. It's a more general point. Okay, fine. Thank you. Anyone else have anything to add on that particular point? I'm just noting that that's a marine license point. Is there anything from the MMO on that?
No.
Fine. Okay.
Thank you very much. Well, look, we've examined the Kent Wildlife Trust position on that. Does the National Trust, before we move away from that particular point, have any observations that they wish to put to us?
Andrew, your National Trust. The Trust would support Kent Wildlife Trust's views and opinions on that area. Just a question, are we going to talk about the other site selection options at this stage? Or?
Yes, I mean, that's part of what we will do here. I mean, as I indicated at the outset, we've got to have a care about this as an exercise, because what we cannot do is examine a scheme that isn't before us. But again, I'm going to put to you the same point that I put to Kent Wildlife Trust at the outset, which was, if you're saying that you believe the appraisal of what ended up being the landfall proposals for this project, essentially picked the wrong horse, what is your view of what the consequences of that should be? What policy is breached, and are you telling us that A, there could be additional mitigation, or B, that there's adequate mitigation in place, but it needs to be clearly managed and controlled better, or C, are you telling us that none of the above, and that actually there are reasons for refusal to emerge from this?
Okay, Andrew Shaw, National Trust. I think as Kent Wildlife Trust said, it's an in-principle objection to the choice because of the potential impacts, but our specific concerns relate more to the work in the environmental impact assessment and the process that goes through to explain the site selection option. And in very short term, at the end of the deadline one applicant's response, they say, on balance, the applicant considered that of the initial three search areas, other options were considered to have greater potential impacts than Pegwell Bay. From the information I've seen in the environmental impact assessment and from this question, I still don't understand how that balance and selection has come about and what the relative weightings and judgments are to make that choice and to make that judgment that the other site options were either not viable or were more damaging. And that's the concern I have from representing the National Trust and holding the protection of the long-term holdings of our land. I need to be assured that that is the right judgment, but I cannot see how that judgment has been reached or what the relative weights and balance to say that those other sites were excluded at the early stage before any of the further detailed work and the additional scoping, site surveys, etc. was undertaken.
Okay. Now, I think given that we're going to kind of dot around a number of topics, I think the fairest and most sensible thing to do would actually be to go to the applicant individually on this item before we move on.
Yes, Scott Lyons for the applicant. Can I deal, sir, first of all, with the point that you raised at the outset, which is where is this all sort of going as far as application is concerned? And you've asked both the Wildlife Trust and the National Trust for the policy basis upon which this objection is being raised. And, I mean, our short position is we don't see any policy basis for refusal on the grounds of the objection that the National Trust and Kent Wildlife Trust have raised. As we understood the representations of the Wildlife Trust in particular, that accepted that EN3 doesn't contain a general requirement to consider alternatives or to establish whether the proposed project represents the best option. And EN3, paragraph 2.6.81, asks for an assessment of the effects of installing cable across the intertidal zone, which should include information about any alternative landfall sites that have been considered and any alternative cable installation methods that have been considered, but that falls short of saying you should refuse an application where you think there's a better option available. We understood the Kent Wildlife Trust representations on this issue. They refer to the Habitats Regulations and reference to alternatives there.
Yep.
But of course, we're not in that territory because as far as we are concerned, there's no adverse effect on integrity, which then requires you to look at alternatives under Regulation 64. So we didn't see anything in EN3 or the HABS regs as referred to by the Wildlife Trust, which somehow required you as an examining authority to choose the best option or to reject our option because you thought there might have been a better one that wasn't fully considered.
Can I just test that as a particular point? Because it could potentially be quite an important one. Mm. And that relates to the proposition that if there were to be, and we're conscious here that we do not have Natural England in the room, which I have to say is a matter of considerable regret, because it would be very useful at this juncture to be able to speak to their advice to us on HRA matters and indeed the advice that they've provided to the applicant, and to actually cover off this question about the degree to which they disagree with you on some points and say that there are some adverse effects on integrity. If they sustain that disagreement, and if they persuade us of it, do we enter then into a world in which we are looking at the broad application of the need to consider alternatives? Or are we in a world where, in your submission, that is an exercise that only need be conducted in a limited manner in respect of the adverse effects that might be specifically raised by Natural England?
Yes. Just Scott Lyons for the applicant. By way of introduction, as we understand it, Natural England do not have any outstanding concerns with the site selection process that has been followed, particularly following the withdrawal of option two. So the starting point is we don't think we're in that territory. That's our understanding. And that can be confirmed through further elaboration on the Statement of Common Ground. As far as the sort of wider issue is concerned, apart from EN3, the question is there anything in national policy which requires you to reject this scheme on the grounds of the availability of another alternative? And there is wider guidance in EN1, which says that the relevance of alternatives is a matter of law. But it recognises that there is a requirement when providing environmental information to give information about the main alternatives that have been studied. There's no issue with that here because we've done that. EN1 also refers at paragraph 4.4.2 to the HABs regs. Again, as far as we're concerned, there's no issue about that here. And as we understand it, there's no suggestion from Natural England that we are in alternatives territory in that sense. There's another aspect in EN1 where it says that it recognises that there may be specific parts of the national policy statements which require consideration of alternatives, and the only possible relevant one is a reference at 5.3.7 in EN1, which says that development should aim to avoid significant harm to biodiversity, including through mitigation and consideration of reasonable alternatives. Paragraph 5.3.7, and it refers then back to the wider section in EN1. Now again, we say that doesn't specifically impose a general policy test of rejecting proposals where there's alleged to be a better alternative, particularly in circumstances where there wouldn't be any significant harm to biodiversity interests. So you ask whether we've avoided significant harm to biodiversity through the consideration of reasonable alternatives. And if that harm has been avoided, it shouldn't be necessary to then ask whether there's some better solution. And essentially, that's where we are. Yeah. In the absence of any evidence about there being significant harm, then there's no wider legal requirement, we say, to consider alternatives. If it were alleged that there was significant harm, which is not the position as we understand it of Natural England, then obviously the examining authority would have to assess whether reasonable alternatives had been adequately considered. But for the reasons I've given, we're not in that territory, sir.
Yes. Okay. Well, look, I've been kind of mulling over the interface between these two conversations and briefly consulting with my colleagues, which I will say you won't have noticed to speak, but wonderfully now we have this on-screen electronic mechanism that we can confer without actually visibly conferring. So, you know, this is the modern world. I thought I would tell you that simply so that when I say we have conferred, you don't think...
Yes.
You don't
some
think...
telepathy as well.
Yeah, exactly.
He's actually not telling the truth. So anyway, we have had a brief conversation about this, and we observe that it would actually be quite useful for an action to be taken by both Kent Wildlife Trust and the National Trust for deadline three, which is the deadline immediately following these hearings. In consideration of what you have heard the applicant put in front of us, are there any other clearly grounded and policy-based reasons that you are putting to us that in your view suggest that there is either a requirement for additional mitigation that isn't immediately secured, or B, that we have entered the territory of the unmitigable and that you suggest that there are reasons for refusal? Because I think it would really assist us for there to be absolute clarity on that point. And if you are citing particular policy, to actually set it out, the applicant can then react and respond to that. So that was the first action that I was going to suggest. And then the second consequential action on that is that I would think it would be very helpful if the applicant could engage with Natural England by deadline three, through the Statement of Common Ground process, I feel is probably the best way of doing this rather than inventing yet another paper product, and to put the point to them about the relevance of the consideration of alternatives within HRA and whether the fact that they disagree with you about the existence of some adverse effects on integrity, which you say are not relevant to the site selection process and apparently are not, whether there are any circumstances arising from their ongoing disagreement that would mean that if that then flows through to a point where the Secretary of State is reported to on that basis, that essentially reopens a broader consideration of alternatives.
Scott Lyners for the applicant. Yes, sir, we will do that. There is a statement of common ground with Natural England, which specifically deals with the topic of site selection.
Yeah.
And we will feed that into that statement of common ground.
It could be as simple as them merely putting a comment on it to say,
exactly,
we have heard the question you ask and we don't think it changes anything.
Exactly. And as far as we're concerned, we don't understand there to be any outstanding issue with Natural England relating to adverse effects on integrity in particular. And the latest position is that any residual concerns that they have with site selection are now addressed, and it may well be a simple case of recording that in relatively short order in the Statement of Common Ground, as you suggest, sir.
That sounds like it. And in that way, we are essentially around this table, all transparent to each other, and if there are any residual concerns, then those are the matters on which we will deliberate. Now, that raises two other points. The first being that the applicant made some oral submissions there about their consideration of policy context, and I trust that those will find their way into the reduction to writing at deadline three. So that's relatively easy. Finally, though, there is a kind of overarching point about how we best engage with Natural England on these matters. Now, we had in mind that we would consider this point later on, but it's arisen much more clearly and needs to be dealt with in the here and now. So, shall we have that conversation?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I did indicate that it was a matter of regret that Natural England are actually not present here today, because we did, in fact, adjust hearing dates at the preliminary meeting, consequent on representations that were brought to us by, amongst other people, Natural England, with a view to being able to hold hearings that they would be able to attend and that didn't clash with hearings for other offshore wind farm processes. We're very conscious that hearings are strongly resource consumptive on public agencies. And this is not in any way an attempt to criticise Natural England for resourcing decisions. However, it does put us in somewhat of a difficulty if we can't have a conversation like the one that we've just had, where matters relevant to the Natural England brief emerge from relevant interested parties, and actually ask Natural England as the advisor to the Secretary of State for their response, if not immediately, at least at the following deadline on that point. And that's why we would have liked them to be here. So what we had in mind was that we need to find a mechanism of getting them here virtually that does not impose further process or further delay in the timetable for the examination. And the only one that we can think of that prospectively works is that we might make a procedural decision. This is really rather odd in their absence, but that we might make a procedural decision requesting them to review the audio of this hearing, and that where matters are put to them in their absence, that they might, by deadline three, provide a written response that actually deals with those matters, so that by deadline three, we're all collectively back where we thought we would be if they had physically attended this hearing. Does anybody have any observations to make about that as a possible way forward?
So, Vincent Kelly, Kent Wildlife Trust.
I think you might need to switch your microphone on, Mr. Kelly.
It is on.
Ah, thank you.
So, Vincent Ganley, Kent Wildlife Trust. I'll just speak loudly.
Thank you.
Sorry, so, yes, I agree as that as a route forward. I just wanted to qualify that through the Statement of Common Ground process, which we're still awaiting, obviously, further consideration of, then what we are looking at is in the view that we believe from the applicant that significant harm will not be caused to the site, and that's been discussed with Natural England, that in our view we just want to verify that that's not devaluing the fact that this is a multiple international designated site, that there are elements to further discuss as concerns, our concerns over the standard of surveys and what has or hasn't been picked up, and that obviously through this process what might be mentioned as we concerning significant harm caused on the site, that potentially the process is actually going forward to saying that the only potential route forward could be the HDD through the site as part of that procedure, and on that basis there are several elements of we've put in significant effort since the application and receiving the ecological information into work on that site.
I am just going to kind of put you on pause there briefly, because as we move through these other lettered points in this item of the agenda, we've got a ground investigation management of contaminated land point, and absolutely we're going to go to the detail of that point that you've just made. I just want to very quickly now just run around the table and check whether anybody has any concern about what we might ask Natural England to do. No. For the applicant?
Scott Lyons for the applicant. No, sir. And for our part, we will try and make sure that the Statement of Common Ground is as full as possible to aid that process.
Essentially here, again, I want to be absolutely crystal clear. We don't want a yet another paper product, in inverted commas, unless that is unavoidable. So if Natural England, receiving our procedural decision, are able to create things that bolt into existing products, yes. Brilliant. But we're conscious that had they been here today, they would have produced a reduction to writing. Yes. And it's that that's missing. And so if anything doesn't have a natural home, it needs to go into something like that as well.
Yes, Scott Lanner for the applicant. For our part, we will endeavour to ensure that anything that needs to be done by way of Statement of Common Ground is built into an existing document, so you will have yet another document to look at as far as this issue is concerned.
Okay. Right.
I suppose we should just add on that point that the audio recording of this hearing should be up within about 48 hours, shouldn't it? Hopefully sooner. So for the purposes of Natural England receiving that, then that should give them sufficient time by the 5th of March. I think something from Kent Wildlife Trust.
Thank you. Julia Hunt, Kent Wildlife Trust. If I understand, you're suggesting that Natural England will provide any additional information that we ask for today by deadline three.
Yes.
If they were here, we would have received their input on the day and would therefore have had additional time to consider and give relevant information by deadline three. Is there a possibility of getting information from them in advance of the deadline so that we can react to that?
Look, we have given some consideration to that particular point. I think the realistic answer to it in the here and now is there probably isn't, because we are conscious that what they're going to have to do is to invest the time, which they sought to try and not invest by not attending these hearings, sitting down listening to the digital audio. They then need to consider what they would have said. They then need to write it down, and there'll probably be some sort of internal diligence and approval process they need to go through. And we're talking about a week, realistically. I think it would be very, very difficult for that to occur. But I do take your point, and your point is that had they been here, you could have had immediate responses to the points that you raised. Now, what I'm just looking, and see, we've got a paper version of it here.
There's not really.
Is there a useful subsequent deadline that we could provide after deadline three?
So deadline four is response to our next round of written questions and responses to things that have come in at deadline three.
There's comments on any additional information or submissions received by deadline three. It's not as early as I would like, but I think the alternative, which is to actually change the timetable for everybody and interpose a brand new deadline, is feeling a little bit onerous.
Can I ask Kent Wildlife Trust on that, just noting your statement of common ground in particular, is that reliant on things that will come from Natural England's submissions here? So at the moment you've got the column for Kent Wildlife Trust is not populated. Do you need Natural England, do you need to hear their views before you're able to progress with that?
That I think it would be useful just so that we have all of the all of the information. just a point on the statement of common ground. I believe that we're still revising that and going over that with the applicant. So it is a draft that is available online.
Okay. So by deadline three, we might see some progress on that submitted document.
Yes. Hopefully, if we can go back and forth with the applicant, then yes.
In which case, unless anybody can think of a better idea, I think what we need to say is that by deadline four, anyone who believes that they would normally and naturally have orally responded to Natural England will review their deadline three submission, or submissions in plural, and will in turn provide any final written comments to us on that material, which of course is a right to the applicant as well. Is that, I know it's not perfect, but it seems to me that that's probably the best and most practical solution that doesn't involve breaking the timetable for a whole load of people that aren't actually here. Yeah? Content. Okay, we will tidy that up and issue that in writing. Okay, let's move back to the agenda then. So we've moved into parts of the subject matters of A through to H. Can I specifically then flag item C, because clearly Kent Wildlife Trust have an interest in this, and the National Trust? Does the National Trust wish to speak on the ground investigation and management of contaminated land point? Okay. Here, I think this is the reason why I'm flagging this is because this is the point at which we need to think about the delivery of the cable route from to the landfall position from the marine environment through the salt marsh into Pegwell Bay Country Park. And we need to be conscious of the applicant's proposal at this point, that option two, they no longer wish to deliver. So we're looking at the remaining options, and we're asking you the question then, what are your remaining concerns about the remaining options, taking account of the applicant's most recently documented position? And two, is there any one option that is a preferred option? Or again, are you saying none of the above? If that makes sense.
Vincent Ganley, Kent Wildlife Trust. Is that working? Yes, we're probably deliberating over the same points made earlier over the existing option, the permit situation as concerns investigative surveys. As concerns the question, is there a favourable option, then clearly I think I've already stated in the room that we would definitely favour the HDD option.
Okay. Anything else that you want to add on that? No. National Trust?
Andrew Shaw, National Trust. I think the only thing to add to that is we still have concerns over the seawall and the connections between the offshore and the onshore cables and how that affects the seawall and any detail of the structures required to achieve that. And we're not clear on what is required or what's involved in making that connection with the interceptor connector array.
Now, having just had those two matters put out by the interested parties, I'm just going to add a little bit. I'm going to do a bit of the embroidery that I foreshadowed, and then I'm going to put these matters to the applicant. Because essentially what we are interested in is the applicant's latest position on the technical deliverability and ground truthing, in the sense of the ability to HDD passing through ground that includes contaminated fill, prospectively, the approach taken to the opening up of a potential vector for leachate into both the marine and indeed the terrestrial environment, and the management and monitoring of that, and whether it is viewed as what is currently proposed is viewed as acceptable. But taking into account that the applicant is hearing from interested parties that there is a distinct preference for HDD over other options, can the applicant just give us the latest position there? Are we in a world where we believe that is a clearly technically feasible option, and it is there even a possibility to narrow down to that option?
Scott Lanners for the applicant. Yes, following the withdrawal of option two, or the proposed withdrawal, the applicant wishes to retain both the HDD and the trenched options one and three. Perhaps I can just elaborate a little on the background. Following receipt of the relevant representations and through ongoing consultation with the stakeholders, we recognised that there were concerns regarding the permanent loss of the salt marsh and the ability to compensate for that. And whilst the ground conditions and contents of the landfill were understood through historical data and ground investigation that had been conducted by the County Council, this didn't relate specifically to the order limits, so the preference was to undertake ground investigation to provide further information. That's been discussed at previous issue-specific hearings. But there is existing geotechnical data on the landfill, which is contained in the Ground Conditions, Flood Risk and Land UCS chapter, and that contains borehole logs, monitoring reports from across the landfill, and we say that presents a robust characterisation for the purposes of EIA. And we think that's adequate to characterise a landfill for the purposes of assessment, as described in that chapter. So whilst project-specific data to refine alignment is the preference, on the basis of that work, we are satisfied that there's enough information to conclude that with relevant mitigation measures, you can rule out any adverse effects. And those mitigation measures would involve the measures to control contamination described in the Code of Construction Practice, which will then form the basis of a contaminated land and groundwater plan, all of which is secured as a pre-commencement requirement in the DCO. So that ensures that approvals required for the measures to control contamination, regardless of the installation option, actually, and the pre-construction site investigation will be undertaken to inform that plan. And as far as option three is concerned, obviously there is the salt marsh mitigation plan, which we can come on to under a separate agenda item. So although we have not as yet managed to conduct site-specific surveys, which we anticipate now that agreement appears to have been reached as informing the preparation of the contaminated land and groundwater plan code of construction practice, we think there's sufficient information to demonstrate that HDD is feasible as one option. But nonetheless, we want to ensure there are other options to ensure that development can take place.
Or another option.
Or another option to ensure that development can take place. And we're not minded at this stage to reduce optionality even further.
Can I just, there's a point that my colleague wants to touch on, I believe, in a second. But before we go there, to put this in a nutshell, you don't want to give up trenching because I would guess you have not yet had essentially detailed pre-contractual conversations with a prospective HDD contractor, and you don't have their view on cost.
Yes.
And deliverability.
Scott Leonard, for the applicant. Yes, sir. Obviously, the decision of which option to take has to take into account time and cost elements and contractor elements, and that's one reason why we want to ensure the flexibility.
And would it potentially be the case that if, for example, we were to be persuaded, as Kent Wildlife Trust seek to persuade us, of the view that actually the trenching option ought not remain on the table, is there a reasonable potential that the consequence of that in terms of limiting to HDD only might actually leave you with an unopenable gateway, an undeliverable?
Sandra Hay speaking for the applicant. We have actually been speaking with some contractors.
Can I just ask you to maybe go a little closer to the microphone? It's the levels are probably not quite good enough.
Sorry, Sandra Hay speaking for the applicant. We have been speaking with HDD contractors with regards to this particular project, and the view is that HDD through contaminated land, it is done, it is possible. There are technical ways of dealing and making sure that contaminants do not find a pathway through the bore. However,
it could also, though, be physical. I mean,
exactly.
You don't know what's in there,
exactly.
And you don't know what you're putting the drill through.
We don't know what we're putting the drill through, but even if that weren't an issue, even if there were no contaminated land there, it's a matter for the natural ground conditions as well that may prevent HDD being successful. And we also know from previous projects, both onshore and offshore, where HDD has been the only consented solution, that actually when it comes to doing the actual activity, something unexpected has happened and HDD has failed, and then other projects have had to revert to other methods of installation.
Could a brief note on that point be put together? Because, and this is, I believe, an action, because I'm conscious of a number of DCOs that link to essentially the method of delivery just being HDD, where the applicants for those particular orders didn't view that as a problem.
Scott Lanish for Vattenfall, just to be clear, sir, you would like a note on why the applicant wishes to retain the optionality?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, now I'm just going to hand over to my colleague briefly.
Only to pick up on this point about the need for further site investigations now not being there. And at the preliminary meeting, we discussed briefly some Section 53 applications that were had been submitted to the Secretary of State, and those are applications for rights of access to land to conduct surveys under Section 53 of the Planning Act 2008. So I just wondered if you could provide an update on that, because it's obviously linked to this point.
Scott Lyons for the applicant. I'll ask Mr. Bates to elaborate, but as I understand it, the last couple of weeks we have had some positive discussions with the landowner and occupier, obviously, and we're confident that the ground investigation in this area can commence. So we're finalising contracts at the moment, and subject to the approval of method statements by the landowner, expecting to undertake these works in the next couple of months. And we anticipate that key outcomes could be shared with stakeholders to help inform the development of the future plan that I've identified, the contaminated land and groundwater plan, as well as the SEMP, actually. So it'll inform detailed design and the contractor's approach to construction in this area. We don't think it's going to be information that's available for the purposes of the examination specifically, given the timing, but we do anticipate that we can get on and carry out those works to inform okay. later plans.
And critically for our purposes, it remains your understanding, and you haven't changed your previous submission, which is that you believe there is enough environmental information yes. in the public domain to enable us to make a recommendation to the Secretary of State.
Yes, and that Scott Linus for the applicant, and that's an important position, sir, for reasons you'll appreciate. That is our position. There's adequate information before the examining authority to reach a judgment on these matters as the information stands.
And again, what I would then put back to Kent Wildlife Trust and National Trust specifically is that if you dispute that, then deadline three really becomes the point at which that needs to be made very clear, and not just that it is disputed, but why specifically it is disputed. What particular, again, policy basis is there for the view that we need that characterisation carried out now, and it needs to be shared with the examination?
Yes. Sir Scott Lanner for the applicant again. Again, this is partly picking up another agenda item, but insofar as the salt marsh mitigation is relevant to any concerns that KWT or in fact the National Trust may have about optionality, you'll be aware that we submitted an updated version of the salt marsh mitigation plan.
Yes.
Through further discussions with Natural England, we're going to be preparing another iteration of that, and we can discuss that through our discussions with KWT, and hopefully that can help inform any wider position that KWT take on optionality.
To assist Natural England when they come to listen to the digital audio record, I'm going to make specifically clear then on this point that amongst the matters that we would like them to review, given their engagement with the salt marsh plan process to date, is this specific question of whether, in their view, that characterisation is a characterisation that needs to be complete and made available to the examining authority within the timescale of the examination, or whether they are content with the applicant's position. Okay, now looking at the remaining agenda items, we have covered A, we have covered C in some considerable detail. The others are matters of individual interest and questions arising from the examining authority. Can I just check whether there are matters about the remaining letters on agenda item 4 that MMO, Kent Wildlife Trust or National Trust wish to speak to?
Is there any?
No. Sorry, do you mind if I ask to just go back just as a confirmation on the last point?
By all means.
Okay, I'll make as brief as possible. Thank you. This is Vincent Ganley from Kent Wildlife Trust. Thank you for that information, and thank you for the consideration and the further information of the HDD, and obviously the removal of option 2, which we thought was the most damaging option. We just wanted to qualify that and add weight to the conversation that we've just had, that we still at present we will find it unable to accept the that the integrity of the site won't be threatened by trenching, and if the applicant finds that HDD isn't feasible, we would suggest that there should be still reconsideration of alternative routes.
Okay. Any final observations on that, Mr. Linus?
Scott Linus, the applicant, no, sir.
Okay. Well, let us move on.
Yes.
Now, in relation to a number of these other matters, there are some that we placed on this agenda in anticipation that, for example, Kent County Council might participate in this hearing. They're not here. They've had their opportunity, so if we were going to have a detailed conversation about construction and laydown areas and the relationship with recreational use of Pegwell Bay Country Park, the opportunity was here. It's not been directly taken. We will give consideration to the degree to which we maybe need to bring out final points of detail in second written questions. Similarly, in relation to the crossing of the Minster Stream and the A256, I think we'll defer that to second written questions. Any other requirements for crossings, etc., the same. Substation construction we had included again in case RAMAC and Crossline or any of their advisors wished to participate in this hearing and speak. And can I just check that that's not the case? Okay. So again, residuals there we will pass through to second written questions. But what I am going to touch on, even though NEMO themselves are not here, is the interface with and crossing of the NEMO cable alignment. We are conscious that NEMO's most recent written position raises considerable concern about essentially the crossing of the NEMO bunded cable alignment with heavy construction vehicles. And so we wanted to ask the applicant whether there was a potential technical solution to that concern, which could include essentially the raising of a temporary bridge across the bunded area that might enable heavy construction vehicles to move to and fro in as many locations as necessary across the existing cable alignment with full protection. Is that something that the applicant could specifically commit to and might resolve that point?
Scott Lennish for the applicant. I'll ask Mr. Baker to explain the position as far as interface with NEMO is concerned, but in short, what we've recalled, the bridge solution is an option that's being considered, and I can ask him to elaborate further on that.
Ian Baker for the applicant. In terms of just setting the scene, construction, traffic crossing, ferry services or third-party services is not an uncommon thing when we're talking at landfalls where there are potential for outfall locations and that sort of thing. The slight uniqueness of this one is that the NEMO cables are surface laid with an above ground berm that provides a sort of slight challenge in terms of how we get across that. Again, though, it's not something that is uncommon, and we have sort of engaged with consultants to sort of come up with some conceptual sort of ideas of how we could essentially achieve, I think, the premise of what you say of making sure that the construction traffic can cross that berm without actually having any sort of impact on the asset integrity below it. One of those options is a sort of temporary bridge solution, which is often used when, say, trying to maintain on a construction route, crossing over a minor watercourse, you would actually put a temporary sort of bridge there just to ensure that sort of route is continued. And it's one of the options that we are looking into. I wouldn't say we want to commit ourselves completely to it would be a bridge solution, because there are other options that we would seek to do. But it's something that we'll engage with NEMO to make sure that, you know, a solution exists that protects that asset integrity for the construction traffic that we'll be going over.
Well, look, let's actually broaden it slightly, because, you know, there is the particular issue of crossing the bund, but then there are also the possible need to cross the buried cable alignment in other locations. Mm-hmm. So there may be different technical solutions that are the best solutions in the different locations. This feels as though it ought to be something that's capable of being drawn into a protective provision, if it hasn't already ended up emerging in your thinking between the applicant and NEMO.
essentially we're flagging it because we would like to see if additional drafting to the order is required, and we can come back to this, but we'd like to see progress on both the technical thinking and actually how that might be managed in statutory terms.
Yes, Scott Lyons for the applicant. We're mindful of both points, sir, the technical methodology being progressed, and our thinking was that a protective provision would be the way to go when we'd be reviewing the DCO in the light of that.
Mm. Similar, I'll not labour them, but similar points could emerge around the crossing of Minster Stream and A256 as well. Okay, does anybody want to say anything else about either of those two matters?
I mean, I think it's both construction phase and O&M.
Yes.
They may have different loading.
Indeed, it is worth saying that there is potentially the need during operation and maintenance to cross the NEMO alignment too. And so we need maybe an O&M maintenance solution when you need to maintain your asset, but you need to cross their asset in order to do so. I would say, and it is no more than an aside, but in our most recent unaccompanied site inspection to Pegwell Bay Country Park, we did see distinct signs of heavy tracked vehicles having crossed the NEMO bunded alignment. Now, NEMO's position on that may be that they shouldn't have. But it might assist us if we knew from NEMO, and again, if this can emerge through a statement of common ground, excellent. If it doesn't, then we'll have to find a way of getting it into questions. But we need to find out what is viewed as the currently feasible loading of that bund and what vehicles are essentially allowed to cross it, because one of your solutions is lighter vehicles crossing it with stuff that's allowed to cross it.
Yes, Scott Lyons for the applicant. We're aware that there are vehicles already crossing over that bund, and that will be the subject of further discussions with NEMO, with a view to reflecting that in any statement of common ground or responses to further questions if that's necessary.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm then finally going to just briefly touch on H, because again, we had envisaged that possibly NGET themselves might be here. There are other places where that conversation can happen, and indeed, other opportunities for us to question NGET, but to just basically again lay a flag so the applicant is aware that we wish there to be better and greater certainty than there currently is about the precise nature of the grid connection to the Richborough 400 kilovolt substation, and a statement, possibly through the statement of common ground with NGET, illustrating that you've solved the technical problems or are moving towards solving the technical problems, and furthermore that to the degree to which they flow across into, for example, the land-related matters, and we can come back to this in the compulsory acquisition hearing, but that if there are land-related matters that also need to be resolved, that they're resolved too. I don't think I really need to say anything more about that in the absence of NGET. In which case, are there any matters broadly arising from that item taken as a whole that the applicant needs to put further replies to me on that it hasn't picked up along the way?
Scott Lannis for the applicant. No, sir, and thank you.
Okay. It is now 11:25. I think it's a sensible time to take a break before we pressure up and dive into biodiversity and HRA. And at that point, I will also be handing over to Ms. Powis. I think 11:40? Yeah, if we can return at 11:40, that would be excellent. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.